There are some massive objects out there in the vastness of space, and some of them are hurtling along at what to us seem to be incredible speeds, like 90 miles per second. You know, I think about that. I've often thought when I'm making the trip to Mom's house in Alabama, which is over 600 miles away, when I see those signs along the way, such as Tuscaloosa, 90, meaning 90 miles, and I think, you know, if I could hold it at 90 miles an hour, I could be there in another hour. Then I'd be only 3 hours from Mom's house. Of course, you see those signs like that all the way, and it takes all day, over 600 miles of driving, and you know, you have to stop from time to time. You have to eat. You have to stretch your legs. I have to do that more now than I did in my younger days. But you see those signs, and you think, if you're like me, you think, you know, if I could travel such and such speed. I was thinking about some of those objects hurtling about in space. If I could travel 90 miles per second, had some kind of flying machine where I could travel 90 miles per second, I could be at Mom's house in a few seconds. Wouldn't take long at all. Or if I could only keep it at 90 miles an hour, that would get me there, you know, a lot quicker, but it'd still take a few hours to get there. And so I always think about that. But you know, 90 miles per second is really rather slow compared to, say, the speed of light. You know, light travels at 186,000 miles per second. That's not 186 miles per second, which would be moving on. That's not 1,000 miles per second, which is considerably faster than 90 miles per second. It's 186,000 miles per second. Well, that would get you to Mom's house in a hurry. Actually, you probably overshoot it many times over. 186,000 miles per second. Now, do you know what a light year is? A light year is not a measurement of time, but a measurement of distance. It's the distance that light can travel in 1 year. How many seconds are there in a year? Well, let's see. There are 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes an hour, 60 times 60. Do the math. You'll come out with about 31 million seconds in a year. So multiply 186,000 times 31 million, and that's the distance. That's the number of miles you will cover in 1 year if you were traveling at the speed of light. Now, an object that's one light year away, it's out there. You know, the number I came up with was, let me see if I can find it here. It was 5766 followed by 9 zeros. That's a pretty big number. And that's how many miles away you would be if you traveled the speed of light, which you can't do, for 1 year. Now, let's understand that there are objects out there that are thousands of light years away. And our galaxy itself covers, I've forgotten the number, it's a huge number. And there are other galaxies, much bigger, much farther away. In fact, there may be billions of them, so far as we know. Lots of galaxies out there, many, many, more than you can possibly fathom. We can't even think in these terms. Now, do you know what a supernova is? A supernova. It's essentially a dying star's last gasp, if I may use something other than scientific language. You know, as a dying supergiant, huge star, not all stars do not go into supernova mode. In other words, it explodes. What happens is that in its last moments, its last gasp, as it were, it explodes. And it releases into space, of course, at incredible speeds, gamma rays, energy, cosmic energy, an incredible amount. I think the number is something like a billion times more energy in that one explosion than the normal star had in its normal burning. It's released into space. Now, we know that there are supernovas that do happen, have happened in history. We see the evidence of them. And we know that in our own galaxy, they happen occasionally. Occasionally, a supernova will occur. A star will explode. A star is a sun. It will explode. We see evidence of it, you know, fortunately, far, far away from us. But this does happen. And we know, it's been estimated at least, that in other galaxies, they also occur. In fact, there are so many galaxies, And so many, if you were to count all the supernovas that occur, is it supernova, the supernovas, all the occurrences, it is estimated that there is one supernova somewhere in the universe every second. That's 31 million of those things a year. And start to think about the massive energy that's out there. Incredible. Incredible. You know, this is not my subject today, but when I think about all of those things and I read what scientists are telling us and how they measure all of this, I'm thinking, you know, can anybody really know God? We know a little bit about Him. We know what He reveals to us. That we have. We know God by revelation. But what is revealed? God knows, of course, that our finite minds can't even begin to grasp His eternal power and Godhead. We can't begin to grasp it. It's too wonderful. It's too great. But anyway, back to supernova. We know that there's one star that's out there. Now, you understand that there are no stars as close as one light year away. There are none from our solar system, from our sun, from our planet. There are no other stars that close. The nearest one, and I should have looked this up, I didn't. I think it's maybe 5 light years away. 5 light years away. A little confirmation here. Others we know are much further away. And they're still in our little neighborhood. We know that there's one out there that's like 8,000 light years from us. And we know that it's one of those giants that someday is going to blow up. It's going to go into supernova mode. Fortunately, it's 8,000 light years away. Now, you want to do the math on that. That's 186,000 times 31 million times 8,000. That's how many miles away it is. But did you know that when it does blow, and tell me, how do you know it hasn't already blown? If it's 8,000 light years away, you know, what you're looking at, when you look, you see that little twinkle, twinkle little star? You know, see it out there, and that's it? What you're seeing is the past. You're seeing light. What's touching your eye, what's reaching your eyes is light that left that star 8,000 years ago. How do you know that thing didn't blow up centuries ago? You don't know. And one of these days, you look up and say, oh, look at that. Well, it's finally getting to us. But you know what's going to happen when it reaches us? It's going to change things. And that's 8,000 light years away. It's going to alter things on Earth. Someone has said it may interfere with evolution because it's going to cause all these mutations because of the gamma ray that reaches us. You know, gamma rays, remember, that's what turned Bruce Banner into the Hulk. Maybe we'll become a planet of Hulks. But no, it evidently will adversely affect Earth. Now, it's also known that if the supernova takes place in one of these much closer stars, it's going to actually wipe out all life on Earth. Not instantly, but it'll take out the ozone layer. We're even if you're down in the cellar of your home, you're going to get sunburned. Eventually, we're all going to die. Everything except some microbes down deep in the earth. I'm sure someday some roaches will crawl out someplace. They're bound to survive. But that's what would happen. You know, hopefully, as you look up at this beautiful starry night and think of the quietness and the beauty, and you know, you think about really what kind of unimaginable energies and powers are there out there? And you think, look at that star, twinkle, twinkle, little star. I hope you stay just like you are. Don't be blowing up anytime soon and turn this earth into a tomb. But there are some unimaginable forces that are out there. Now let's talk about something else that's unimaginable. I don't think these are things you ought to worry about. And no need to worry. If it happens, it happens. But really, you know, it's going to take... We're pretty sure that the closest stars have not blown up or not going to blow up. Some of those more distant ones, they definitely will, but they're not going to have quite the effect that the closer ones would have. And when we're talking about closer ones, you know, those that are in our neighborhood, we're still talking about some great distances. So we just don't know. Some of these things are uncertain, I'm quite sure. And who knows that maybe by the time it happens, we'll have figured out some way to create some kind of shields that will protect us from it. Who knows? In any case, let's talk about something else that's equally unimaginable. You know, there was a time when Einstein's theory led directly to the concept of a black hole. You all have heard of black holes. These are massive. Well, first of all, how did black holes get there? Well, evidently from the old supernova. When a star explodes, then the mass that remains implodes, and it creates a gravitational field so powerful that even light can't escape it. You know, light is a material thing, and light is trapped inside in the gravitational field. So when you look out into space and you see only a little black spot, there is no reflection of light because light is trapped. So all you can see is the blackness of space. You don't know that anything is there. And the reason they know that something is there is because of the activity that's taking place around this area. For example, in the center of some galaxies, they used to think not in our galaxies, but now they think, oh yes, our galaxy too. In fact, it may be the norm for all galaxies. But it was discovered that there's this black hole in the center of galaxies, and that there are little sprinkles of light all about. These are planetary bodies. And that from time to time, some of those closest to the inside disappear. And they're gone forever. Where did they go? Just went out? No, they were drawn into this powerful gravitational field known as the black hole. Now, Einstein's theory led to this, but you know Einstein himself rejected belief in black holes. He just decided he didn't want to believe it. So he didn't. He also, his theories also led to certain concepts of quantum mechanics, and I think he decided not to believe some of that either. He kind of let those things go. Maybe that was even too much for Einstein. But now we know, we're pretty sure, there are still a few holdouts. There are some scientists who don't believe in black holes. They believe that there's some other explanation. But more and more, they do believe in black holes. Now, there was a time that it was thought that black holes were few and far between. I've got some bad news for you. No more. It was also thought that they were stable. Really bad news. There are wandering black holes. Now I've got some extra bad news for you. Some extra bad news. A few years ago, one was discovered near us, in our own stellar neighborhood. Now, you're looking a little nervous there. But yeah, it is scary. When I first heard it, I thought, whoa, it scared the daylights out. Well, it didn't really scare the day. I thought, because I was thinking about what would happen. And, you know, of course, now, fortunately, these things are slow. They only move at about 90 miles per second. That's slow, you know, comparably. And if one were to enter the outer parameters of our solar system moving at that slow speed, and if it were on a trajectory directly toward Earth, you know, we'd have 100 years left. So you and I probably wouldn't be here. But if we were, we would start to see signs as the black hole approached. We would start to see changes in the atmosphere. Then one day, and then, you know, the real clue that it's over is when you hear that huge, huge sucking sound as the atmosphere rushes off this planet and is sucked into the black hole, as you see the seas being drawn up, the trees uprooted, you flying off into space and being literally stretched where the particles that used to be your head are going to be here, and the particles that used to be your feet are going to be miles away, and you're going to be a stream and drawn right into that thing, and this whole planet Earth, will be sucked into it, and it'll be no more. It's gone. It will literally be ripped apart, and everything that you know, everything you have touched, everything that you have known in this world will be gone. It will become a part of what is called the singularity, because it's drawn into this black hole. And of course, we'll move on out in this cosmic vacuum cleaner to, you know, suck up some other planets and things that are out there. Now, you know, another scary thought is that it's not just one of these things out there. There are evidently, at least it's estimated, there are thousands of these cosmic vacuum cleaners moving about our galaxy. Thousands of them. Do we have any hope at all? Whatever happened to good old-fashioned hurricanes? Give me a few asteroids, but not black holes. So there are wandering black holes. But listen, there's some good news on the other side of this. There's some good news on the other side of this, and that is that when I say near, we're talking in cosmic terms. The thing is, after all, 6,000 light years away. When I first read that it's found in our stellar neighborhood, I thought, "Oh, directly over our sun." That's the way it was reported. Well, that's 6,000 light years away, and it's and the reason they know it's there is because it's packing a lunch. Somewhere along the way, somewhere out there, they think maybe a couple of billion years ago, probably shortly after it was first formed, it found a star, and it decided it would go dancing with the star. And so they've been doing the dance for the last couple of billion years. At first, it was a massive star, it is estimated, it is believed. And they're revolving, the black hole and the star are revolving around each other, and the black hole is continually feeding off the star. It's drawing energy from it, has been doing so for a couple of billion years, and now the star is much smaller. You can see its bones, as it were. It's feeding on it and continually feeding on it. In another few hundred thousand years, maybe a billion, I don't know how long it's going to take, it'll completely consume it. But that's how they know it's there, because it keeps feeding off this star that it's doing this seemingly eternal dance with as it moves about across, you know, our stellar neighborhood. But again, 6,000 light years away, do the math, 186,000 times 31 million times 6,000, that's how many miles away it is. And its orbital path is not, our Earth is not going to get into it, so don't worry about it. It's just that one we don't see out there yet, that we don't know about since they don't reflect light. That's the one that we ought to worry about. Actually, we don't need to worry about any of those things, because the odds against it, it sounds terrible when you talk about it. It sounds like, well, man, something's going to swallow us up someday, considering all the forces in this universe. But no, you're talking about such vast distances, and the odds are astronomical, literally astronomically against it, that such a thing as that would happen. It'll probably be some of those hurricanes. It'll probably be some of those volcanoes. You know, those things are not, don't sound so bad anymore, that will eventually get us. But it is something to think about. These are some frightening things. When you first hear these things, it sounds frightening. You think, you know, we're so vulnerable. We're so tiny. We can be snuffed out so easily, it seems. Now, speaking of frightening things, turn to chapter 8 of the book of Revelation. Chapter 8 of Revelation. And you know, these plagues that are described in the book of Revelation have been interpreted variously because of the simple reason that so much symbolism is used in their descriptions. And to be honest, I'm not absolutely certain as to the meaning of some of these things. They do seem to be, at least some of them, some of the plagues, some of the trumpet plagues and the bowl plagues that we'll read about here, do seem to be describing cosmic disturbances of some sort. It could be the result of a supernova that happened a long time ago, and that finally we see the evidence of it in the time of the end. It could refer to some of those things. It could refer to meteor showers or asteroids hitting the Earth. But in any case, let's look at some of these things that begin to happen in chapter 8. When the seventh seal is opened, then John sees seven angels having seven trumpets. And each of these trumpets, when it sounds, this represents one of the plagues that befalls the earth. This is another thing that I'm really not absolutely certain about. When it says the earth, is it talking about the whole globe? Or is it talking about a specific location? Because the word earth can simply be translated land. Some put geographical limitations upon this, but again, that's an uncertainty. That's one of those things that I wouldn't want to take to the bank with me. In chapter 8, and the first trumpet says, verse 7, the first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Of course, you know, if the greenery is burned up, if the trees are burned up, this is going to radically affect our life support system, because the plants, the vegetation, that's an important part of it. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. This sounds like volcanic activity, although I'm not sure. And a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. The word wormwood refers to an herb that is a very, very bitter herb. What is this? A comet? An asteroid? Something of that nature? Who knows? I'm not sure. Some have said, suggested it's actually a reference to volcanic activity. The volcano, the ones that spews objects into the air along with lava and other things, and it falls to the earth. And, of course, when it falls upon the waters, it affects the water supply. But, again, I'm not sure. And then the fourth angel, the atmosphere is struck, and then John sees, and it says in the ancient manuscripts, an eagle flying through the midst of heaven saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. In other words, here are these things that have happened affecting man's life support system. The vegetation is burned up. We see the seas are affected. We see the water supplies, pure water supplies are affected. And the atmosphere is affected. What else is there? It sounds like something cosmic in nature is going on here. And it does affect man's life support system. And now here's this eagle flying through heaven saying, whoa, 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 it's going to get worse. And he goes on to describe these other things. Now, let's don't read through all of that, but let's skip on over to the final plagues that fall in chapter 16. These are called the vial or the bowl plagues. And we're told in verse 2, when the first bowl is poured, it says, so the first went out and poured his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These are plagues from God in this case. Obviously they are, because it seems to single out those who have the mark of the beast. And then the second bowl, I'm not going to read all of these, but the sea turns to blood. The third bowl, the waters turn to blood. This reminds you of the plagues that befell Egypt. Again, are we take this absolutely literal, in an absolute literal sense? I'm not really sure. But I would say that certainly there's some literal component here. The fourth bowl, then men are scorched, and the fifth bowl is poured out. Darkness and pain befall the ungodly. And then the sixth bowl, the Euphrates is dried up. And the seventh bowl, the earth is shaken. Here you have a massive earthquake, evidently. So here you see some of these things, many of which seem to be cosmic disturbances, others which seem to be things that happen in the earth, volcanoes, earthquakes, and things of that nature. So it's at the very least, it sounds that when this period comes upon the earth, it will get a lot of people's attention, to say the least. And the point here is that these things befall the ungodly, and we're told in two or three places here that men still didn't repent when these things began to happen. Now, and back in Matthew chapter 24, we find another prophecy that speaks of cosmic disturbances. And here again, this has been interpreted variously, but I would say that there must be an element of literalness to this, and I'll show you why in a few moments when we compare with Luke's narrative. But in Matthew 24, verse 29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So here again, cosmic disturbances. Now some have said, well, this is the language that the prophets used in reference to the fall of Babylon, the captivity of Israel in ancient times. They would always speak of the lights going out, as it were. It's not a literal thing, but this is symbolic. That may be the case, but I'm not sure about that, because Luke adds some more details. In Luke's account, in chapter 21 of the book of Luke, verse 25 says, "And there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations." Now, if the signs in the sun, moon, and stars are simply symbolic of distress of nations, why does he mention both here? It seems to me that you take both literally or both symbolically, and you can't have it both ways. So both must be, he must be speaking literally. "With perplexity, the sea and the waters roaring, men's hearts failing from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." So it appears that he's using a literal language here, not merely the language of the prophets, to symbolize the distress of nations, simply because he speaks of both the distress of nations and the signs in the heavens in one breath here. So there is room for uncertainty on the precise meaning of these prophecies, but they do appear to speak of literal cosmic disturbances affecting this earth. I know for certain that such realities do exist, that an exploding star far, far away can affect life on earth. I do know that there are such things, some frightening things out there, things that could affect us, things that have already happened, but by the time the effects reach this earth, then they're going to begin to affect us. Well, this brings me to the real hope of mankind. It is not fleeing the planet by flying away. Now, some people, sci-fi fans, like to think in terms of someday when this earth is no longer habitable because of, well, whether it's an approaching black hole or whether it's due to supernova exploding far away and the effects finally reaching us, or whether it's due to, well, who knows, an alien invasion as far as that goes, or some other thing, some other terrible type of disturbance, such as a comet headed right toward the earth, or a comet hitting the earth and causing massive damage. Some people like to think in terms of maybe someday we'll have the capacity, and you've seen this in sci-fi movies, where we actually get aboard all these, some kind of spacecraft that have been created, and leave the planet and go in search of some new home someplace. Or maybe live aboard those things if they're livable at that time. But even then, I wonder, would we be able to create shields strong enough to shield out some of the stuff we would encounter out there? Seems that we're just not going to get out of it alive one way or the other. But in any case, the biblical hope is not presented as flying away. It's not presented as going to heaven when you die. That's not the hope that's presented in Scripture. The hope. And it's far more than just personal salvation. That's an important thing. Certainly we strive for and wish to obtain the resurrection. That's what we're looking for, the transformation when Christ returns. But the hope, the real hope of humankind, is not presented merely in terms of personal salvation, but it is actually presented in terms of cosmic renewal. Look at Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21. And starting in verse 1. "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea." Now, some people have taken this literally. There won't be any sea, literally. And I wonder about that. I don't think this is to be taken literally, and I'll tell you why. Because in the book of Revelation, you see the sea is the source of evil. The seven-headed beast is seen coming out of the sea. The abyss, the habitation of demons, is down under the sea. So what he's telling us here, there's no more sea, there's no more source of evil. There's a new heaven and a new earth. It doesn't tell us that on the actual earth itself, on the planet itself, that there won't be any waters, there won't be any oceans. I don't think that's what it's saying. But continuing in verse 2, "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. So here we have a vision of a time of cosmic renewal, of cosmic transformation. When this order of things, when this earth, when the heavens and the earth themselves are transformed, that tells me that what we see now in this universe is not the end of the story. What we see now is an unfinished work. It will give way someday to a new heaven and a new earth. And you know, I believe that's exactly what the Apostle Paul has in mind in Romans, the 8th chapter. If we'll turn back over there, the last scripture for today, Romans chapter 8. And see what he says here concerning the time when the sons of God will appear and thereafter. It says in verse 14, "For as many as are led of the Spirit, these are the sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together." Now verse 18, he says, this is Romans 8, verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope." So this is looking beyond the mere creature, that's you and me, to the creation itself, to the cosmos itself. He says it was subjected to futility. And when I look around and see what science tells us, I say, boy, was that ever true? You look at the massive forces that are out there and realize just how an unfriendly environment the universe really is in a lot of ways. The deadly things that are out there that could come our way. So it's subjected to futility. "Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait it with perseverance." And you know, this is the whole purpose. We eagerly await the time when we will receive the hope. You know, the millennium is only a phase. It's only a stepping stone. But the real hope looks beyond the 1,000 years. The real hope set before Christians is not only personal salvation, certainly includes that, and is something we should be striving for, but it includes, it actually is cosmic transformation. When this present heavens and earth, this present universe, this present cosmos gives way to God's ultimate purpose and becomes a new heaven and a new earth.